Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can always find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Roy Eisenhart, and I'm happy to be your moderator tonight for our evening with Joseph Ellis. As you all know, Joseph Ellis is the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, author of many books, particularly in the period of the Revolutionary War, and we're here tonight to hear him discuss his newest book, Revolutionary Summer, The Birth of American Independence. Joseph Ellis is well known to all of us, but I want to summarize a few highlights before we begin. He is considered, as you know, one of the nation's leading scholars on American history. In fact, I saw one quote that said, he is the Roger Federer of American historians.
That was the greatest thing I ever said about him.
I thought that was pretty good. He has written a total of 8 books, of course, and awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Founding Brothers, The Revolutionary Generation. And he won the National Book Award for American Sphinx, the biography of Thomas Jefferson. And to complete the trio, he has done an in-depth chronicle of George Washington, the title of that book being His Excellency George Washington. All of these, of course, were bestsellers. We're here tonight to discuss his newest book, Revolutionary Summer. And I think that what we should do is, at this point, turn this podium over to Professor Ellis and let us hear from him about that book. Thank you very much.
Go back that way. Thank you for that gracious introduction. I've been here once before. This is a really venerable venue. In my view, the most important political speech in the 20th century was delivered here by Franklin Roosevelt. It actually prophesied the New Deal and explained why the role of government had to change for demographic and historical and economic reasons in a way that a lot of Tea Party people ought to listen to these days. I'm told I should talk for no more than 20 to 25 minutes. That's hard for me, but I'll do it. I'm obviously here in a thinly veneered attempt to get you to purchase this undoubtedly magisterial volume. That will be the last time I mention it because I don't feel totally comfortable trying to hawk my own wares. However, I have one son left in college, and any contribution to the Alexander Ellis Scholarship Fund will be enormously appreciated. I am trying to tell a story that's one of the oldest and most familiar and oft-told stories in American history, how the American Revolution happened. There are a lot of misconceptions that are easily corrected, but the challenge that I have is to try to tell it in a distinctive and fresh way. Every generation of American historians has told this story, and at times in doing the work on it, I felt like I was stripping layers of wallpaper. Each generation had its own interpretive layer of wallpaper to get back to the original wall. And so some of the things that I have to say are not really new. They're so old that nobody knows them anymore. They knew it back then. And one of those things is why a consensus developed for independence in the late spring of 76. And I'll try to offer you an explanation there. As I came to work on this book, I began with a presumption and a question. The presumption was that no event in American history which looks as inevitable in retrospect was more unlikely and problematic at the time. So that part of the job of the historian is to tell this story in a way that recovers a sense of confusion and of improvisation. My old mentor, Ed Morgan, who just passed away yesterday, is probably the greatest early American historian of the late 20th century. He used to say that a revolution is a change in human events so turbulent and so traumatic that no one understands it at the time or ever after. Now, this is not a good definition for a historian to have, because we're supposed to be able to explain confusion clearly. That's a challenge. That's a challenge, and that's one of the things that I'm about in this particular book. The question that I had, I call the Wilkes-Barre question. Very clever. The population of Wilkes-Barre is about slightly larger than the population of Virginia was in 1776. Now, if we went to Wilkes-Barre today and we walked down the street, do you think we could find George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, George Mason, John Marshall, and Patrick Henry? You ain't going to find them. Now, at some theoretical sociological level, they're there, latently. There are people with leadership talent that, if offered the opportunity, could perhaps rise to the occasion. But one of the questions then is, how come we get this surge of leadership at this particular moment? And there is a kind of generic answer. It's the Toynbean answer, after Arnold Toynbee, that leadership requires a great crisis. It's only when you get a great crisis do you get the opportunity to have these people ascend into prominence and leadership roles. Well, that makes a lot of generic sense, but we can all think of a lot of moments when we have a crisis and there is no leadership, like now. So what was it? And you can't argue it's something special in the water, because that's, you know, or you can't say God came down and blessed the, you know, United States of America. That's, we don't admit supernatural explanations. And I don't have a really good, I mean, I can tell you it's partly because the American society, while not a fully egalitarian society by any stretch, was open to talent in a way that France and England, for example, were not. Alexander Hamilton was a bastard, literally. He would have never made it. Washington would have made major in the British Army. John Adams would have been a country lawyer. So that there is something to the fact that this is an open society, again, in a way that doesn't satisfy our full definition of that, but for the time was impressive. I'll give you an anecdote, however, to try to get at this in a more emotional way. When George Washington decided to attend the Continental Congress in May of 1775, he put on his military uniform. He knew we were going to war. Now notice, this is one of the things that needs to be underlined in your understanding of the story. I know that chronology is the last refuge of the feeble-minded, but it's the only refuge for historians, okay? The war starts 15 months before we declare independence. The war starts in April of 75 at Lexington and Concord. One of the bloodiest battles in the war is June of 1775 at Bunker Hill. We don't declare independence until, obviously, July of 76. Washington already knows it's going to be a war. Part of being a leader is to have a sense of the future in your bones. And when he leaves Mount Vernon, he gives these instructions to his manager, Lund Washington, who is a second cousin. He says, when the British come up the Potomac to burn Mount Vernon, not if, but when, get out my books and Martha, presumably not in that order. He assumed he was going to lose everything. This is a crisis that requires an all-in mentality. By the way, in 1779, a British frigate does come up the Potomac and anchors off of Mount Vernon. And Lund sends a little skiff with fruit and presents out to sort of appease the British captain. And the captain says, "Man, I'm just fishing for herring." He has no hostile intentions. So he writes to Washington and tells Washington what happened. And Washington writes back and says, "I am extraordinarily and exceedingly upset." Why is he upset? "You have stained my honor. You have attempted to appease a British officer. If it happens again, let them burn it to the ground." Again, this is what we're dealing with here. Okay. And it's an honor-driven society, especially in the army, in the officer class of the army. I'm going to try to move quickly to cover some things that I would take longer, but we're going to cover a lot of these in the Q&A, the back and forth. Okay. The American Revolution was an unnecessary war. It was obvious to both sides what the diplomatic resolution was. And while New England was ready to rock and roll in 1774-75 because they were being occupied, the rest of the American colonies really were reluctant to go to war with the major military power on the planet. The British Army wasn't that much better than the French Army or the Prussian Army, but if you put the British Army and the Navy together, they're invincible, as France will discover. So, in England, both Edmund Burke and William Pitt embraced this diplomatic solution. In the moderate section of Congress, John Dickinson, Thomas Jefferson write to the British Parliament and the British King offering this resolution. What's the resolution? What's the diplomatic answer? Okay, Parliament says, "We're not going to tax you or legislate for you. We're going to recognize that your colonial legislatures have that sovereign ability. You will remain in the empire under the authority of the king and under the economic reign of the Navigation Acts. You benefit from those mostly anyway." You would have, in effect, invented the British Commonwealth 100 years beforehand. Okay? And both sides knew that option was on the table. And they were expecting that option to be the one that eventually resolved the conflict. A consensus on independence doesn't develop until the middle and late spring of 76. And it develops for a particular reason. The British, and this means George III, okay? It's not his ministers, it's not Parliament, it's George III. He wants to declare himself a real monarch within the British system. That's pushing the monarchy forward as an equal player with Parliament. And he says, "We're going to invade America with the largest amphibious force ever to be sent across the Atlantic. 42,000 people, 437 ships. Next time a fleet that large goes across is in World War I. We're going to squash this rebellion in the cradle." Why do the British decide this? This will turn out to be the biggest blunder in the history of British statecraft. Number one, Blackstone, the great jurist, says, "There must be a single source of sovereignty in any government or empire. You can't let each colonial legislature do its own thing. It must, in the end, be, in this case, Parliament." Okay? So this is a very Aristotelian position. Notice Madison in the Constitution thinks you should have multiple sovereignties. It's like, is there one God or many gods? But from a constitutional point of view, the British think they don't have the luxury of permitting Americans to have sovereign legislatures. Second, a version of the domino theory. If we let the Americans get away with this, what happens in Scotland? What happens in Ireland? What happens in India? Okay? That's not a good signal for an empire to be sending to its colonies. And third, why should we negotiate since we have such military superiority we can't lose? So let's go do it, squash this rebellion, and round up the suspects. They'll eventually sue for peace, round up the ringleaders and hang them, and then we'll go let them come back into the empire. Well, that's the reason the colonists decide on independence. How do I know that? I have evidence. On May 15th, John Adams writes a resolution in the Continental Congress, and he says to each of the colonies, if you believe that we should go head towards independence, you should rewrite your colonial constitution or charter to a state constitution or charter. And this goes to all the governors and states. Adams always thinks this is the real Declaration of Independence. One of the reasons he thinks that is because he wrote it. He always thinks Jefferson gets credit for this, you know. The governors and legislatures in each state sent that request to every county and town in this colony, Quim State. So like in Massachusetts, 42 towns. Guess what? In this obscure 1840s collection of documents called, American Archive, 9 volumes, 1,000 pages each volume. If you look hard enough, you can find every one of those towns in Massachusetts and counties in, say, Virginia. And they all say the same thing. They say, we can't believe we're saying this. Only a few months ago, it would have been impossible to imagine us committing ourselves to independence. But given the invasion and given the behavior of George III, he is not our monarch. He is not the person who we can turn to rescue us from Parliament. He's the most tyrannical of them all. It helps that Tom Paine has written this pamphlet called Common Sense at the same time. Though Paine's pamphlet is as influential as it is for the context in which it appears, as well as for the argument that it's making. Okay? So that this was an avoidable war, and the British send two generals, the Howes, Richard Howes the admiral, and William Howe is the general, to lead the British invasion. The fact that they picked the Howes is really fortunate for the Americans. Because in this battle on Long Island, now if you notice, New York is an archipelago. Staten Island, Long Island, Manhattan. Whoever controls the sea controls the battle. It is indefensible for the Americans. Why are they going to defend it? Well, the Continental Congress tells Washington he's supposed to defend it. Civilian, but it's more than that. Washington has an honor-driven definition of battle. If the opponent appears on the field, he is duty-bound to respond in the same way that he would to a summons to duel. The Howes are invading in Long Island. That's where I go to defend it. Stupid. Suicidal. He's going to start with 28,000. He's going to end up with 3,500. Pardon me?
Brooklyn Heights.
Brooklyn Heights. That's right. And the escape from Brooklyn Heights on the night of August 30th is the greatest military tactic of the war for Washington and for the American side. More so than crossing the Delaware, because he gets his whole army across the East River. If they don't get across the East River, they're all going to be captured or annihilated. They're trapped. And it has to work perfectly. The nor'easter has to be blowing. The fog has to come in at the right time. It's, you know, it's an even more dramatic version of Dunkirk. The papers don't report it because, and I read 17 newspapers, the papers don't report the American defeat. The papers report an American victory on Long Island. It's treasonable to tell the truth. Any newspaper man that tells the truth, his newspaper is going to be closed down. Anyway, the two British generals, the Howe brothers, bring to this a certain attitude. They don't want to destroy the Continental Army. They want to stun it, deliver a stiff blow that demonstrates to the Continental Army and to the Continental Congress they can't win the war. They do that, first on Long Island and then on Manhattan. Easy victories, American casualties and captures, very few British casualties. Then they say, okay, you've seen you can't win. Why don't we talk about reconciliation? And we have terms to offer you. And they meet, and they send Franklin Adams and this other guy, Rutledge, from South Carolina, to meet in the Stone House on Staten Island on September 11th. Howe says, and Howe and Franklin are friends from London. They work together to try to avoid this situation. Both the Howes think this war is misguided, by the way. They voted against the war when they were in Parliament. And he says, let's end this silly business, and all you've got to do is step back from independence, and then we'll let you have control over your own legislatures. And we're going to hang some of you. But anyway, the response of Adams and Franklin is really interesting here. Adams says, there's no turning back. There, once upon a time, if you'd proposed those terms, we would have been willing to accept them. It's too late now. Too many people have died. We've crossed the Rubicon. Plus, you're assuming that if you can defeat the army here, that makes a difference. If you kill everybody in the army, we'll just raise another army. We've got sufficient manpower to field an army of 150,000 if we need to. Demographically, people between 15 and 50, if they serve, we can. You know, we'll find another Washington. That's not going to be easy. Franklin says to Howe, look, Sir Richard, I know you think we can't win, but I'm going to tell you, you can't win. Because it's not a conflict between armies. It's a conflict between the British army and the American populace. It's a war for hearts and minds. And you cannot win that war. Or you can only win it at a cost that the British people will never be able to pay. I think our own experience in Southeast Asia and the Middle East makes us more aware of the dilemma the British Army faced. Okay, and so the question often asked is, how could an army of amateurs defeat the greatest military force in the world? And that's the way Washington put it, too. He said it was a standing miracle. I always wonder what a sitting miracle would look like. But it's possible that the question now should be changed. Did the British ever really have a chance? And I think they did. They had to win it quickly, and New York was their one and only opportunity. They missed it. And then after that, Washington stopped this honor-driven definition of battle, okay? He saw that he had to fight what he called a war of posts. It's not quite a guerrilla war because it is a conventional army, but he's never going to allow the Continental Army to be totally at risk. He's not going to fight unless he has a tactical or numerical advantage. And that is the trick. Namely, think about this. There are all these great generals in world history. Washington is not a great general. He loses more battles than he wins. A lot of the great generals, like Hannibal, Napoleon, Robert E. Lee, Rommel, they're all losers. Washington's a winner. Washington wins the war. He has the key insight. He doesn't have to win. The British have to win. That makes all the difference in the world, because eventually they're going to go away. And that's what happens. I've taken up more time than I was supposed to, and all the battles and stuff are in the book, and it's hard to talk about them in a public way that is, catches the specificity. But I was asked, this is a question, it might be controversial. The op-ed editor at the LA Times asked me to do a piece when we were ratcheting up the war in Iraq, and she wanted me to do a piece with, it was, what would George Washington do in Iraq? So I said, well, he wouldn't know where Iraq was. He wouldn't know about weapons of mass destruction and jihad and all that kind of stuff. And bringing a historical character like that into the present is like trying to plant cut flowers. Okay? She says, that's fine, write the piece. So I wrote this piece in which essentially I said, Washington would say, we have become the British. And he wouldn't understand that. If you ask most Americans, is the United States an empire? A majority will say no. If you ask everybody else in the world, they all say yes. We are an empire in denial. And part of the reason we're in denial is because we know that our imperial status is fundamentally at odds with our origins. And our origins as an anti-imperial republic aren't really compatible with the kind of power we're exercising right now. But we are. And I leave you with that somewhat disturbing thought. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joseph Ellis. And I'll take just a moment to remind our radio audience who are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we have the pleasure tonight of being with Joseph Ellis. And we are going now into our question and answer period, mostly answers, and I must say I have a formidable task because there are so many good questions that what I'm going to try to do is integrate as many of them as I can so we don't go over
the same thing.
The same thing. Thank you. That's what Roger Federer would have said.
I'm so pleased you came up with that. That was in a book review by Dan Okrent.
Right.
And it had to do with backhands and forehands, yeah, and stuff like that. I thought, that's great.
Yeah. Maybe he could have compared you to Thomas Jefferson. That
way. Now, but, I prefer Roger Federer.
Okay. Several people are interested, before we plunge into some of the historical nuances, there are several questions about you and how you got drawn to your focus on this particular period of American history.
Well, I was trained at Yale as an early Americanist, but most of what I was doing as a graduate student and early professor was in New England Puritanism. I have a former student sitting out there that had to do some of that stuff with me, Tracy. But eventually, I began to embrace the idea that the late 18th century was the mother lode, the big bang in American history, from which the ideas and institutions radiate out, and we're still living under the institutions created at that moment. What's the name of that famous bank robber in the 1950s?
Willie Sutton.
It's my Willie Sutton theory. Remember when they asked Willie why he kept robbing banks and he kept getting caught all the time, and he said, because that's where they keep the money. And that's where they keep the money. Mm-hmm. Plus, I think that, and this might be a little bit too much inside baseball, but starting in the middle of the 20th century, each of these major figures became the subject of huge scholarly editorial projects, of multi-volume projects, some of which are still proceeding. Jefferson will never end, I don't think. And they move at a glacial pace. But they created the largest body of documentation about a political elite ever recorded in world history. And at the same time that this body of documentation was coming available, the profession, American history, was moving in another direction. It was moving in a direction of race, class, gender, in which you don't want to study dead white males. And so I said, you know, all power to you that want to be studying, say, midwifery on the main frontier, 1783 to 1785. But I want to study George Washington, and or John. I first wrote about Adams, and so I'm a bit of a weird duck within the profession. Though I think within the larger society, people are more interested in what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. That's the reason. Now I'm not doing it just because people buy books about these creatures, and although that's nice. But I really do think this is the most creative political moment in American history, and we can never know enough about them.
And several people ask, because we've talked about Jefferson and Adams and so forth, but what about Dickinson?
Dickinson. John Dickinson is actually, in the 1774-75, the most powerful person in the Continental Congress. And he had written a pamphlet back in the 1760s called Letters from a Pennsylvania Farmer, which was an early statement of the colonial right to control its own taxation. We don't know as much about him. He's not as lionized. He's got a college named after him in Pennsylvania, Dickinson College, because he picked the wrong side. He couldn't vote for independence. Now, even though he didn't vote, he went down to fight in the militia, in the Delaware militia, to help oppose the landing of the British in New York, as a matter of fact. Adams was always asked about Dickinson because they didn't get along, and because Adams was the radical and Dickinson was the moderate in this during this time. But essentially, Dickinson counted on George III to do the right thing, and George III did exactly the wrong thing, and he left him out without any political place to stand. Dickinson will come along in the 1780s and be a player in the Constitutional Convention, though, mm-hmm. though he's sort of an anti-federalist. But Adams said it's because he was married to this Quaker woman that if anybody was married to her, he would go insane. That's what he really said. And,
fortunately, there wasn't Twitter then.
Adams would have had a very brief career if there was Twitter then.
We talk about phraseology and how, and you mentioned it, how so much of what we think about ourselves today is rooted in language of rising out of this period about which you write. And one of the phrases, of course, is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm. And one of our questions is curious because it at least derives in part from Locke's phrase of life, liberty, and property.
Property, right.
And they're wondering why the transition was made.
At the same time he was writing these words in mid-June in Philadelphia, the Virginians down in Williamsburg were writing the Virginia Constitution. And the guy who was doing the preamble to the Virginia Constitution was George Mason. And George Mason wrote a preamble in which he said, life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Hmm. And that's where he got it from, because it was published in the Pennsylvania Packet at the same time that Jefferson was writing that. But you can also argue plausibly, that this is the one place where Jefferson is making a clear statement against slavery, because it is the property that's going to be used by the Southern planters to justify slavery under the revolutionary principle, you know, mm-hmm. and you can't take my property away from me. It's by dropping property that he removes that. Hmm. And when they debated in the Williamsburg convention down there, the planners are very clear, keep that property in there, maybe. And pursuit of happiness also, when asked about it later in his life, he made things up, you know, and as we all do. And and he said that that's a grander, you know, that happiness isn't a function of wealth. That there are many forms of happiness that will not be possible for people who are not wealthy, but that they need to have the right to pursue their happiness in whatever way they want to. So that's operative too. But you got, you know, that is the most important 37 words in American history. And we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. When the women get together at in upstate New York, Seneca Falls, in 1848, they begin their resolution for women's rights. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women. When Lincoln gives the Gettysburg Address in 1863, he says 77. Mm-hmm. That's 1776. Right. He's reinterpreting the Declaration to mean that that slavery is wrong. And when Martin Luther King gets up on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in 1963, he says he's coming to collect a promissory note from Jefferson ending segregation. I mean, I did a piece for the San Francisco Chronicle on this, in which I said, last sentences, for our time, for the younger generation, at least for sure, the meaning of those words has expanded to include gays. Mm-hmm. Now, none of that would have been imaginable to Jefferson, okay? But that's what the words say, and that's what they've come to mean. And so they're the basics for the liberal agenda in American history. More so, you know, all these guys that are jurists, like lawyers, they think that the Constitution is the document. It's interesting, you know. Lincoln thought it's the Declaration. Mm-hmm. That's the real principles. The Constitution is just the legal framework in which you argue about these principles.
The dialectic that you just gave us, which is really fascinating, ties into a question, because I'll put it this way. What you just said implies a flexibility in what those words mean as social values evolve.
Yeah.
Yet we have a judicial doctrine of originalism, which suggests that they are frozen in their meaning. And I wonder if maybe you could comment on that.
Well, the doctrine of originalism, as advocated by Justices Thomas and Scalia, is historically preposterous. I mean, first of all, the founders don't themselves agree on what the Constitution means.
Right.
Secondly, they all said, don't make this written in stone. Jefferson expected to be a new Constitution every 20 years. Every generation. The last thing they wanted was to be regarded as the source of original intent.
He said, written in blood. Didn't Jefferson say that?
I don't think so. But I'm not sure what you're referring to. Yeah. What I'm saying is the people that are the founders don't believe in originalism. Okay? Originalism has become a doctrine that allows the conservative members of the court to do away with stare decisis. This is how they're going to overturn Roe v. Wade. It's because they can claim, and, I mean, you're going to get me going here, but, like, the Second Amendment does not say that you have a right to bear arms. That's a natural right. It says that that if you serve in the militia, you have a right to bear arms. And the Second Amendment and all the amendments were written by Madison. He actually wrote 12 of them. They reduced it to 10 because in 7 of the state ratifying conventions, ratifying the Constitution, the respective legislatures submitted suggested amendments to the Constitution, a total of 124 of them, okay? None of them had to do with the right to bear arms. 11 of them had to do with the fear of a standing army. The Second Amendment is really about the fact that national security would be in the hands of militia rather than a standing army. That's what it's really about. And Scalia's attempt to discover the natural right to bear arms is like the CIA's search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You can be damn sure he's going to find it.
Welcome to San Francisco.
Actually, I've had a rap on this.
I remind our radio audience once again that we're listening to Joseph Ellis talk about his new book and related topics, Revolutionary Summer, and we are proceeding with audience questions. Clearly, someone has already read your book. Many people have, but in terms of this question, they say that you do an interesting thing, which is not that common, and that is to join the political and the military aspects of this year. And could you comment on that?
That's my major contribution, I think. People have told this story primarily as a political story centered on the Continental Congress. Major players, Adams, Dickinson, Jefferson, Franklin. Some people have also decided to write about the military side of this, like David McCulloch did a great book called 1776, in which it's all about the Continental Army. I'm saying you got to put New York campaign, the Continental Army, together with the Continental Congress to understand the story, because they're intersecting. Okay, I told you one thing. The reason you get consensus on independence is because they're being invaded. Okay? It's a militarized situation. It's no longer just a constitutional argument. And then the Howe brothers make decisions about how to fight in New York based on their perceived effect on popular public opinion. They're not winning, fighting for territory. They're really fighting for hearts and minds. If we can just demonstrate conclusively the Continental Army can't win, they'll just give up. It will break the will of the rebellion. So it's going back and forth in that way that gives that story a different chemistry. I'm also doing something I try to do in most other things, that I'm trying to recover the way it looked to the participants while periodically stepping back and saying, in hindsight, we can see that that's misguided or da-da-da. So you've got the advantage of immediacy with some sense of the historian's perspective and advantage on that. That's tricky to do without being too clever, but I think that's what I do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Had you done that in any of your previous?
Yeah. And whenever you can say hindsight, but there's different ways to talk about this. When you look at the interpretations of the American Revolution, the layers of wallpaper, every generation interprets it through the cultural values of its own context. It's unbelievably obvious, So getting back to the primary sources and getting back to the recovery of that psychological and political mentality, that's the first order of business. And then I think I recognize that my interpretation is very much a function of my recognition of the war of the Vietnam War's impact on my thinking about the British Army, but I'm upfront about that. Mm-hmm. You can't escape your present, even if no historian is going to be able to do that. And the study of historiography is just like each wave is washing against the shore in its own unique way. No, I'll shut up here. I'm talking too much.
You don't have to. A question which really ties nicely into what you just commented on goes basically to how one writes history. Because in your preface, I'll read this because it's short, you say that you tell this as a story, which means that narrative is presumed to be the highest form of analysis, and recovering the way it looked to the participants must precede any imposition of our superior wisdom in the present. That's a pretty powerful sentence, and maybe you could expand on that.
That's what I was trying to say in many too many words, that the phrase narrative is the most powerful form of analysis would be controversial within the profession. I think that people who write history that is read would agree with it. Mm-hmm. But that the vast majority of professional historians are writing for each other. Mm. And they are writing within a particular methodological groove, and the story is less important than the assemblage of evidence, sometimes excessive assemblage. You know, they've done all this research, they can't afford not to tell you about it. The single most important thing to keep in mind when you write a story is what to leave out.
Yeah.
It really is. And I believe that narrative is the highest form of, and I have Herodotus and Thucydides on my side.
And Barbara.
And Barbara Tuchman.
Yeah. Who, her little monograph on narrative history is...
Yeah. Definitely. She's great. I remember when I was a graduate student at Yale, she came to New Haven and not a single member of the history department came to see her.
Because?
They thought she was a popularizer. A couple of us graduate students went. And also, she was a woman.
Yeah.
There wasn't anybody in the history department that was a woman there.
Why do we have, and this is my own question, but you really resonated on that. Why do we have this tension? We see it in science, not just in history. Anything that is for the popular public, the reading public, the people who are trying to learn more, is viewed with some disfavor in the academic world.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, and a lot of times, it's really simple. They're jealous. They want to do it and they can't do it. Now, there are certain kind of popularizers like Bill O'Reilly. I mean, how in God's name does he get his books on the bestseller list, for God's sakes, you know? I mean, but hey, I'm a card-carrying historian. I got a PhD, all right? I mean, most of the people writing American history that's read are people like David
McCulloch
and, pardon me? Right. And what's the guy that did the Washington biography? Ron Chernow. Stacy Schiff. Now, let me tell you, baby, Stacy is a real pistol. You want to, she wrote a biography of Franklin and on Cleopatra. None of them are historians. Mm-hmm. They're journalists. But they write very well, and they know how to do research and tell a story. And I'd rather be with them than some of my professional colleagues. I like to think of myself as a crossover historian. I can write, I mean, if you look at the book, there's a lot of footnotes in there. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a scholar, you can read it and learn in this way, but that I'm also writing it in a way that for people that don't know anything but are smart. Which is really the kind of people I've been teaching for 40 years.
If they know they don't know anything, then they're smart.
No, they know they don't know anything.
Yeah, that's when you're smart.
I make sure they know that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Speaking of knowing things, another question that comes up is, in all your years of writing, when you wrote this book, did you actually find something new? A new fact that you didn't, or a new insight?
One thing I mentioned that nobody's known and I didn't know is that the press coverage of the initial stage of the war is totally patriotic. There's no accurate reports of the actual battles. And so the strategy of the House, which is to break public opinion on this, was never going to succeed because nobody knew what was happening.
Yeah.
And remember, they didn't have cell phones or TVs or radios. And people were born, lived their lives, and died within a 20-mile radius, so that it was not easy for people to know what was going on far away. That's a tidbit of a fact, but it's one that I had never known before. I didn't also know how much the big argument, there was totally the change in the chemistry in the spring of 76. I still would have attributed greater significance to Payne's pamphlet, but it's really clear that the military change, the military invasion is what changes and galvanizes public opinion. So that it's funny as the Dickens, but we've seen the Americans and do the same thing. They are launching this huge military offensive in order to squelch the rebellion. The act of launching it creates the rebellion.
Yeah.
I've seen this movie before.
Yeah. Actually, it's not that unusual for countries in a time of war to propagandize the news. I mean, you saw
no.
that during
no.
the Second World War quite a bit.
Yeah, but it's really overt here. I mean, it's not like they're not, you know, it's like they make it up. They're not just not reporting what happened. They're saying, and the Americans destroyed the British Army, and it's, you know, they were left in shreds on the beaches of Long Island, you know?
And I think the point you made about the Howes, Brothers Howe, miscalculating their, as you described, the little punch to the Continental Army, ran on the rocks of the fact that nobody knew that it happened.
That's partly true.
Yeah.
That's partly true. Plus, the guys in the Continental Congress who are going to make the decision, you know, about whether they're going to consider this, all of these guys are on the list to get hanged.
Yeah.
So it's like not in their interest to consider this. Now, if you took an actual poll on the countryside, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, we know that 19 to 20% of the populace was loyalist.
Yeah.
Loyalist. Or Tory. But the other 80% is not all patriot. It varies from region to region. In New England, solid. If you're against the revolution, they've already killed you or sent you away. But there's this middle group of probably 20 to 25% of people that want to be neutral. They just want this thing to go away. And I think they would have been vulnerable if the American army was destroyed. I think that could have tilted it in that direction. But Adams, Franklin, Jefferson, all those guys, Washington, they're never going to... They talk about the cause. Capital C-A-U-S-E, the cause. That's what they believed in. And it's the best kind of conviction because it's based totally on faith. They always said, Thomas Aquinas had to have five proofs of God. If you really believe in God, you don't need them. And they believed. And this was not going to change. They were going to go down fighting or else they were going to win.
I'm sure there's been research on what I'll call the marginalized groups, the slaves, women, and Native Americans.
There's not a lot of stuff on them. I mean, people are interested in those questions, to be sure. I mean, most of the Native Americans sided with the British, which was a big mistake. But they were going to have their land taken away from them anyway. There are some slaves that escape to the British Army, especially in the latter end of the war when they're going through Virginia. In fact, seven of Washington's slaves escaped to the British Army. And some of them early in the war escaped to the Army in Virginia, some of Jefferson's slaves. Most of the slaves that escape die of smallpox. The British Army is riddled with it, and they have no immunities whatsoever. There's very few blacks that fight for the British Army. You see novels written about that, but there's not. I don't know of any. There may be one or two, but when Cornwallis is trapped in the Tidewater, Virginia, Yorktown. He has about 600 African slaves with him, and he just lets them go. And most of them got smallpox all over them.
You mentioned that Adams would have been a country lawyer and Washington would have been a major. What would Thomas Jefferson have been in British society?
Maybe an architect. When he ran for the presidency, one of the things the Federalists said, he would have been a great college professor. That was considered an epithet, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
yeah, I take it.
He's got, you know, many sides to him, to be sure. Though the book I wrote about him, American Sphinx, they don't like it down there in Charlottesville. I've got some critical things to say about him. And but he is impressive in terms of his intellectual range. There's no question about that. And his letters are great. When you read Washington, it's da 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 da, and although Adams's letters are really good too. I used to teach a seminar in which we would read the Adams Jefferson correspondence in late from 1812 to 1826, and everybody starts thinking they're going to like Jefferson's prose. And then, did you ever take that course, Tracy? Yeah. And like then you read Adams, and like, and so this one student. Way back when, said, Jefferson is this. Adams is this. Like a punch. And he's really got it, too. But those two are real great stylists. So is Franklin. Hamilton's papers read like battlefield memoranda. They're very succinct. Washington can be eloquent on occasion, but mostly he's boring. He's a poet.
Yeah. Question that I had in mind, my mind wandered to that answer about being the poet, and I think the incorporation of the thoughts of the Declaration of Independence, not just in the Gettysburg Address, but in the second inaugural.
Lincoln's second inaugural, probably the greatest speech in American history. And I mean, really, if you read that, that is poetry. It's difficult to know what was in Jefferson's head when he wrote those words, okay? It's clear that the Continental Congress didn't think they were that significant. They thought they were a kind of rhetorical overture. The real stuff was the grievances against George III. They spent a day and a half making 83 changes in the Declaration. Jefferson sits there excruciating. They're mangling my text. They didn't change a word in that paragraph. They let it get by. I have a chapter called The Dog That Did Not Bark. The Sherlock Holmes story about the dog. That's the most important thing that happened, that nothing happened with that paragraph. And it just slipped by. And essentially, Jefferson slips the entire liberal agenda into the founding document. And that is the American creed. Mm-hmm. If you want an immigrant to come into America and know what America is, don't have him read the Constitution. Have him read this.
Yeah.
That's what it really is. And it is an expanding text. But so is Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And the founders intended us to interpret their actions and words from the point of view of our own experience. And so we're back to the stupidity of the originalists. And we still should know what their words were.
Yeah.
We still should know who they were and learn as much about them as we possibly can.
They're highly adaptive, basically. We have time for one more question, and I will remind before we go to it, our radio audience, you're listening to Joseph Ellis, and fascinating discussion about the American Revolution, particularly his latest book, Revolutionary Summer. Let's take the few minutes we have left and have you tell us why July 4th is our celebration of our Independence Day, but really the facts are a little...
Yeah, like nothing happened on the 4th. Really. What happened on the 4th was they sent it to the printer. And then they sent it to the printer, they put the date on the top.
Yeah.
So that's the reason it's memorialized. It's confounded by two things that confuse most Americans and confuse me for many years. There's a famous portrait, the original hangs in the Capitol Rotunda by John Trumbull. It's called The Declaration of Independence. And it shows five guys coming up to a desk. Three of them are recognizable. They're Adams, Jefferson, and Franklin. The guy behind the desk is John Hancock, the president of the Continental Congress. And if you look it up in Google, some of the facsimiles say July 4th, 1776. It's not July 4th. It's June 28th. It's when the committee delivers the draft of the Declaration to the full Congress. Okay? Adams writes to Abigail on July 3rd, beloved Abigail, and he says, "Yesterday will be the day to live in memory. It will be the national anniversary. There will be parades and speeches and illuminations." He gets everything right, right down to the fireworks. He gets the day wrong. He says, we get the day wrong. July 2nd is the day they voted on the resolution for independence. It's a Virginia resolution. These colonies are and have every right to be independent states. That's the big vote. Adams thinks that's it. Yeah. Instead, they decide to, and then they spend a day and a half revising this document called the Declaration. He again thinks Jefferson gets too much credit for this. You know, he really burns him. But if you think about it, if it was the wrong date, Adams and Jefferson decide to make it the right date by dying on July 4th, 1826. Okay? And, I mean, after that, you know, nobody could make that one up. And no. Not even me.
No.
And so
not even
then, and Walden goes, I mean, Thoreau goes out to Walden on July 4th, and Lee retreats from Gettysburg on July 4th, mm-hmm. and God knows what other things happen on July 4th.
Yeah. Isn't that an extraordinary
event? Indeed. 50 years later. Yep, yep. You can't make that kind of stuff up.
Okay.
One more question.
Well, I'm going to conclude. That was my one more question.
Ah, okay.
I'm going to conclude by reading to you a comment on one of the cards because I think it summarizes all of our attitudes. "I've had the pleasure of reading all of your books. I greatly admire your ability to portray these people as humans with a tangible personality. Thank you." So we thank you, Joseph.